This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Maybe not every weekend of the year, but surely 25 times or so each year, I drive from my home in Litchfield County to what I think is one of the most beautiful places on this planet. The White Memorial Foundation is a sprawling park and wildlife habitat right in the middle of the town of Litchfield. There are so many winding trails zigzagging its 4,000 acres, I haven't even walked them all despite coming here for about 20 years. Those trails take you through marshes and through fields into pine forests and to the edge of Bantam Lake. In the heart of the foundation is its conservation center, now celebrating its 50th birthday. It's a nature museum that uses the park to teach about native species and the habitats that they make home. Today, Where We Live, we are broadcasting live from the White Memorial Conservation Center. We'll be talking about this place and the people who maintain it for the public. We'll meet some of the native critters who make this place home. If you've ever wanted to hear me interview an owl, yes, that's coming up later on the show. But first, I want to welcome in Jerry Griswold. She's Director of Administration and Development at White Memorial Conservation Center. You may also know her as the longtime voice of morning traffic reports on WTIC AM. Jerry, it's great to be here, and it's so great to have you on Where We Live.
We're so tickled that you guys are here today. Thanks, John.
Could you just tell us a little bit about this place? We're going to get more into the history, and we're going to bring in some of your colleagues, but just tell me about what this place means to you.
Oh, my goodness. The people that created the White Memorial Foundation, Elaine and May White, 101 years ago, gave the greatest gift to Northwestern Connecticut, the gift of open space. And they endowed it beautifully, and it's managed beautifully today. The face of Litchfield County would look totally different if it were not for the legacy of Elaine and May White. Not only do we have our 4,000 acres here in Litchfield, but the Whites also gifted 6,000 acres to the state of Connecticut that is the foundation of our park system. If you've enjoyed People's State Forest, Kent Falls, I get goosebumps. I've told the story a zillion times. I get goosebumps. Campbell's Falls, People's State Forest, Kent Falls, and many, many other properties that you've come to know and love that are now considered state parks were gifted by Elaine and May White. So imagine what Litchfield County would look like without their generosity.
And that park system is celebrating its 100th anniversary.
Right.
And so it's a big part of what makes Connecticut, Connecticut, all mm-hmm. this open space. But this is different. This isn't a state park. How is it different as a foundation, as a conservation center than the state parks that we know?
Well, it's a living, breathing laboratory. There's free parking.
That helps.
There's just nothing like us. Nothing like us. The Whites set out to obtain 100% of the land around Bantam Lake, and they acquired 60% of it. So still, homes on Bantam Lake sit on leased property that is maintained by the foundation. And our executive director and his group, skeleton crew, this place operates with so few people, you would be amazed. You'd think there would be this legion of people that maintain White Memorial, but it isn't just a handful of really hardworking folks. But they make sure that native plantings are on properties, that people are managing that land properly. So the whole gist of it is to maintain the legacy and continue the legacy of Elaine and May White, and to keep this pure and clean and educate children and bring the public in and get you out in open space. I always say that a baseball diamond and a soccer field, that is not open space. Get your children out in nature. For me personally, the foundation of who I am today rests in that backyard in Winchester. So I was really happy to come from the urban jungle of full-time broadcasting to White Memorial 7 years ago, where this is my office, this is our lab. It's a pretty good gig.
It's a really good gig. It's surrounded by all these beautiful fields and woods, and we're going to be learning more about what's in those fields and woods in just a moment. I do have to ask, though, we've done programs on the state park system. We've talked an awful lot about the importance of open space preservation here. How is this all maintained and funded? Because you do have free parking, right? It's mm-hmm. not $10 to roll in. So how do you pay to keep all this great?
It's an endowment, and we're landlords, of course, because of the land on Bantam Lake. So it's a very unique nonprofit organization. There are people that say they want to model their nonprofit after White Memorial. There's nothing else like us, as far as I know, anyway. So it's a very, very unique organization. And, relatively quiet. A lot of people don't know that we exist. So, again, we're so happy that you're here today to get the word out. We're just waiting for you with open arms.
Well, and where we are, once again, is the White Memorial Conservation Center. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary. It's 101 years for the foundation itself, which is this 4,000-acre park. And we're going to be learning about about some of the native species that are here. I want to welcome in a few folks who are a big part of the Conservation Center. Carrie Shred is education director here, brand new to the White Memorial family. Welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And also James Fisher is here. Jamie is the research director for White Memorial. You've been here 9 years or so. You made this place home. You're a big part of it as well. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Maybe, Jamie, you can just start by talking a little bit about some of the habitats that surround us, because one of the things that really intrigues me about this park is that you go to some of the state parks, and they're obviously beautiful places, but they tend to be one thing, a dense forest or a beautiful beach. This is a lot of different types of habitat, and it's in this fairly compact area.
Absolutely. The number of critical habitats at White Memorial is just astonishing. It's really a dream for me to study a place and to research a place that has such diversity and juxtaposition of various things that you don't find everywhere else. And we even have habitats that are even unique just to Connecticut. We have a medium fen that it's Cranberry Pond, and you don't find those everywhere. It's really kind of a cool place to just explore and tromp around in. I'm the kind of person that likes to get my hands dirty and my boots muddy, and I don't think there's a day when I don't. But the opportunity to explore the wildlife and the plants and the various other creatures are it's a mind-blowing experience. And so, not only as a scientist but as a naturalist, it's a real gem and a jewel of a place. And so we have lots of other naturalists who come here and express the same interests and joy.
Well, talk a bit more about the range of the different habitats. Here, you talk about this unusual fen area, but there's different types of marshes. There's pine forests. There's not a whole lot of elevation change, but there are some hilly areas.
Absolutely. So the vast majority of the property is upland forest that can be either deciduous trees that lose their leaves, or pine forest or conifer forest, and those would be the needle type trees. Then we have a variety of various wetlands, and they can be herbaceous dominated wetlands, they can be forested dominated wetlands, shrubby wetlands, and there's a whole suite of critical species that are found in each of those habitats that indicate to us that they are important habitats. And then we have vernal pools, which are they're ephemeral bodies of water in the forest that dry up each summer, and they'll flood in the spring, and they'll sometimes flood in the fall if we have enough rain. And we have various species of animals that utilize those habitats. And so even though they're ephemeral by their nature, they're really important for a variety of critical animals and species that because of that hydrology, that pattern of drying up and flooding each year. Then we have the Bantam River itself that flows through the property, and the lakes and the ponds that offer a variety of opportunity for recreation, whether it's kayaking, fishing, or boating, and swimming and that kind of stuff. So, it's a lot to discuss in a small amount of time, but yeah, we have a really neat group of places.
Well, what I'm wondering, and maybe you can tell us a bit, and Jerry, I'd like you to jump in too, is this idea of welcoming in the public in the way that you do, and you want people to explore and experience and use the trails and use the rivers, but you also have to maintain it. You have to maintain it as a wildlife habitat. You have to maintain it so that it keeps this character, but you want people out in it. How exactly do you do that?
I have no idea how we do it. It is the most unique balancing act I've ever encountered, and I don't know if I've never encountered this anywhere else, where I've seen the mission statement as simplistic but as broad as it is, because it's not just recreation or conservation; it's also education and research, and we try to meld all that together. And yes, we are always concerned about activities that by their very nature seem to be non-consumptive, but they still have an impact. And we are always trying to make sure that even though people may by their best intentions not have an impact, we try our best to minimize that impact that they may have unintentionally. We're conserving the primary aquifer that supplies the drinking water supply for the borough and most of the residents of Litchfield, and I mean that's a it's a nuanced activity, because on one hand we have all this other activity going on, but underneath all that there's drinking water supply that has to be charging people's own homes every day. So
Jerry, talk a bit more about that, because that balancing act of bringing people, and you want people to come in, but people cause damage even when they're trying to just have fun. How do you mitigate that?
We work with the Connecticut DEP conservation officers that come and patrol the place, you know, at night to make sure no shenanigans go on, because let's face it, kids are kids. But I have to say, though, I'm administration and I'm usually stuck up in an office. I might as well be in a skyscraper most of the time. I think that we have a great deal of really respectful people that come through this property. And I think that true nature junkies are that way. We're not looking at people that are off-roading on the trails a lot and causing disruptions. And you know, Jamie has a lot of work, salamander cover boards. I don't think that people are going into the woods and upturning them. I think people are generally very respectful.
Yeah, in general, they are. But at the same time, we're always...
Just keep your dog on a leash.
Yeah. There's that. And,
yes, please.
And then there's also, you know, we have the trails are not open to vehicles. They're open to bicycles and horses and people walking, but they're not open to vehicles. And so there's gates at the trailhead, and there are the rules are posted, and we do our best to encourage an open dialogue with our members and the people who use the property.
Don't ride your horse on the boardwalk.
Yeah. And there's signs up for that. There are horses all over the place.
Sure.
Ride the horses here, but some places they shouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's, you know, where else will you find a place where you sometimes will encounter a horse-drawn carriage being carted through the forest, and you see a small family on that and enjoying nature that way, the same way that Elaine and May White enjoyed the property. Where else do you see an opportunity where you see someone towing behind them a kayak so that they can get into one of the remote ponds so that they can go fishing? And it's not something that you encounter everywhere, and yet there's still that desire everyone here that they want to leave it so that they can come back to it.
Yeah. I wonder, Carrie, if you can talk a bit about your role here and the educational piece of all this, because getting people to use the property recreationally is a big part of it, but obviously the Conservation Center is an education facility at its heart. So talk about some of the work that you do.
Sure. I just want to add to the last conversation there that one of the main philosophies that we try to instill in the kids that we see is that leave no trace or pack it in, pack it out. So hopefully we're teaching them from a very young age to respect nature and leave it as they saw it so that future generations can enjoy it as much as they did. So that's one of the things that we definitely try to emphasize. We have programs for kids age pre-K all the way through high school, and we deal with kids that are coming from the schools, not only in Litchfield County, but we even get some schools from surrounding counties. And then we also have kids, especially during the summer, that are just signed up for camp programs. Maybe they come here with their families. That's how they know about the park, and they want to learn a little bit more about it. So, and I've had a couple kids from summer camp this year that actually live in New York City, but they're up here usually staying with their grandparents on vacation. And so it's so neat that they take the time to spend one or two of their weeks of their vacation here at White Memorial. So we just really try to get kids out in nature. I mean, that's really what it's all about. It sounds simple, and yet in this day and age, it doesn't happen with a lot of children. So our goal is to really get them to establish a connection with nature that they wouldn't normally have. And these are kids that, you know, what I've learned from them this year is that nature and their other activities don't have to be exclusive of each other. There are kids that come in here that are also really into Minecraft and compute, like all these crazy video games, and yet they still take time to come out in nature. So it's not a matter of pitting one against the other. It's just having kids that are well-rounded, that get to experience lots of different things, and hopefully nature is just one of those many things that they do throughout their childhood.
And as we talked about before, with the various habitats, it's a great laboratory. It's a place where you can actually maybe sit and have a conversation about what you're going to see, and then go and see it within 10 minutes, and actually a fairly short hike away, you have all these things right in front of you.
Right. I just to give an example of some of the activities we've done during summer camp. And actually, I should say we don't just stay on property, although there are so many cool things to do here, but we go off-site too. We've climbed mountains, we catch crayfish, we look under Jamie's salamander boards for what lovely things live underneath. Of course, we put them back when we're done. We try to not have an impact there. We studied birds yesterday. They each had to learn a call, and then when we heard it out in the woods, they had to identify the call and list three things that they learned about the bird. So it's really just it's not just classroom learning; it's really experiential learning.
And I know, Jerry, for years you've led hikes here, and not just education stuff for kids, but there's a lot of ways to come out here and just get guided tours of this property.
Yeah, I'm in charge of Saturday programming, and I was finding in the beginning that a lot of people weren't bringing their children to Saturday programming, that kids are tied down to games or, you know, baseball, soccer, ballet class, et cetera, et cetera. So my numbers were tanking on the weekends, and I said, well, the heck with the kids. Let's focus on adults and let the kids come along if they can. And it's turned into something really wonderful for us, where we do a lot of adult programming on the weekend. Children, of course, are always invited. But one of the things I like as a former chef is to try to take upstairs in the museum is a beautiful display of the way Elaine and May White utilized this gorgeous property, and a lot of it was al fresco dining. So there's nothing I love more than taking my old career as a chef and at the end of the Cranberry Pond Walk, which we do annually in November, laying out a table with cranberry blueberry pies and eating al fresco. So if you're coming on one of my walks, you know you're going to be fed. Now, my boss is the only reason people come to my hikes is because they get fed, but I think he's wrong. I think that people just really love to get out there. So it's fun. I have a very creative mind, and it's really fun to try to get the bait that's going to get those folks over here and out in nature, and then if you're well behaved, you get a treat.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to have a little bit of a treat here. We're going to be introduced to some of the animals that you show people. I think we've got owls and bats, snakes, a porcupine?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. Indeed. So we'll see. We're visiting with Jerry Griswold, who's Director of Administration and Development here at White Memorial Conservation Center in Litchfield. You may also recognize her voice, the longtime voice of morning traffic reports on WTIC-AM. But no traffic here today. We're just talking about these beautiful, beautiful woods and the surrounding area. Carrie Shred is here. She's Education Director for the Conservation Center, as is Jamie Fisher. He's a Research Director. When we come back, we're going to get some of our questions from our audience who've joined us here at the park, and we're going to meet some animals. We'll be right back where we live. Live from White Memorial Conservation Center in Litchfield, Connecticut, this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Today we're visiting with some of the people who make this amazing place go. White Memorial Conservation Center is part of the White Memorial Foundation. It's a 4,000-acre park right in the heart of Litchfield, right up against Bantam Lake. It's woods and fields and marshes that I've enjoyed for years, but it's the first time I've gotten to do a radio show here, so it's a perfect time to do it because it's a great time to visit the park. It's their 50th anniversary as a conservation center, 101 years as a foundation. Of course, the White family donated so much land around the state to our park system, which is celebrating a big anniversary this year. We're visiting with Carrie Shred, who is the education director here, Jamie Fisher, who's the research director, and Jerry Griswold, who's the director of administration and development at the Conservation Center. We're going to get to some questions from our audience in a couple minutes, but we've brought friends here today, and the friends are actually animal friends. Who do we want to meet first? We have a turtle and a snake.
Well, let's meet Corny first. Corny's a corn snake. I mean, you probably could deduce that from his name. And not a native species to Connecticut. We tend now at the Conservation Center to have only animals on display that are native, to discourage people from buying animals that are lovely to have at the moment and then discarded later, either into the environment or They can't find a home for them. But Corny is quite a unique snake in that he's just a really lovely animal to use for birthday parties. And also, in terms of the corn snake world, the world of corn snakes, there is no more beautiful corn snake than Corny. I mean, I've seen a zillion of them, and I don't think I've ever seen one as lovely as Corny. But he's very easy to handle. Children love him. He's a bit of a superstar, and we use him in birthday party programs primarily, but he's not on display to the public.
And the coloring, kind of a brownish, auburn, beautiful
orange
markings.
The Native American blanket, gorgeous. He's just a gorgeous thing.
Beautiful. But again, not a native species,
right.
and that's sort of an important thing. Jamie, obviously we end up in our state with an awful lot of invasive species, and something we talk about quite a bit. And so part of the mission here is to talk about species that are native to these woods, and so people can go out and experience them. I'm quite sure that, like every place else, you have to deal with some problems of invasives, whether they be plants or animals.
Absolutely. It's a real problem, and we're exploring it all the time with regards to how it's potentially impacting the processes that we rely on in these ecosystems. We also worry about the fact that there are some things we don't know much about. And right now, this summer, I'm exploring the non-native earthworms that live at White Memorial. All of our earthworm species in Connecticut are non-native. They're not native to the continent at all.
How'd they get here?
Yeah, good question. It seems to be that they were brought into the continent by landscaping industry, plants being brought over for horticultural purposes and so forth. And then they get transported around quite a bit by bait fish, the fishing bait. They get just people dump their worms at close by to where they were fishing, or we transport topsoil or compost or mulch. They get shifted around a lot that way. And then once they invade our native ecosystems, primarily forest ecosystems as well as others, they start to change the way that ecosystem functions from the ground up, literally. So they are true ecosystem engineers in that regard.
So it's funny, sometimes we'll have a guest on the show who, if I'm not talking to them enough, they'll maybe give me an annoyed look. But we actually have our next guest is wildly waving his arm, saying, talk to me.
Notice me.
And this is Rocky?
This is Rocky, our box turtle. And talk about a superstar. I've just found out that he is on the cover of brochures and maybe someday magazines, who knows. But Rocky is a male box turtle. Box turtles are native to this area. Some of you have probably seen them before. A lot of times we see them crossing roads just because, unfortunately, our roads cut right through their territories. And so when they're on their way from one spot to another, they have to cross our roads. Box turtles, now Jamie could probably go into more detail about this, but I think that they're not as common as they used to be in this area,
That's correct. Yeah, they're declining.
We did a program on turtles not too terribly long ago, and there are some species that are quite a bit in decline. And then, as I was talking about earlier, there are some species that are sold as pets and often let go in the wild, mm-hmm. and those will predominate places. But this box turtle is a native species.
Yes, absolutely. Now, one cool thing about box turtles is you can tell if it's a male or a female by the color of its eye. So next time you all see a box turtle and help it across the road, you can just take a quick look at it before you set it on the other side. Look at its eyes. The male box turtles have these bright red eyes, like Mr. Rocky here, whereas the females tend to have more just brown eyes. You can also tell the males have a concave plastron, which is the undershell. Females tend to have a flat plastron. And males tend to have not as domed of a shell as the females do. So unlike other turtles where it's a little bit more difficult to tell, with box turtles, it's pretty easy. So just some neat fun facts next time you encounter a box turtle.
And like some of the animals that we'll be meeting, this is a rehab animal. The Conservation Center ends up with animals who have been damaged by humans or some other way in the wild, and they're here to rehabilitate Jerry.
Right. I don't know if this is – I don't really know Rocky's full legacy, but he did have a dog tag on his shell when he came to us. Our gift shop manager, Lois Melarano, is a Cracker Jack wildlife rehabber. He came to her for some reason. Perhaps somebody even surrendered him, because it is illegal to possess an animal like this, as it is all wildlife in Connecticut without proper permits. And the Connecticut DEP believed that it was best that he stayed in captivity, because you don't know what he's been exposed to or what he could bring into the fragile environment outside. So I think it's worked out really well. It was a win-win for everybody. Mm-hmm. Win-win for children, win-win for Rocky, for the Institute of American Indian Studies. We hear there's their poster child down there, and he's a superstar.
Right.
And as you can see, he's very shy.
Right.
If you want an interview or want to pet him, have your people call our people, because he doesn't give autographs.
Yeah, lots of times with box turtles, I like to show that their special capability is the fact that when they pull their legs and head in, they have a hinge on the bottom of their shell that they can actually completely close their shell. With Rocky, it's impossible, because you cannot get this guy to actually go in his shell. He just wants to go out. I can't. So anyways, you'll just have to trust me on this one.
Well, and very quickly, Jimmy, we were having an interesting conversation beforehand. Questions about turtles laying eggs, and people want to obviously maintain these species, protect these species, but we see a couple things with turtles. A lot of them get crushed on the roadway, which is too bad, because they don't move across very quickly, and many of them, they lay eggs, and then those eggs are decimated by the local predators, things like foxes or skunks.
Foxes, skunks, raccoons, yes, and what's actually worse for our turtles here in Connecticut is the fact that they get killed on the roads, because this is a group of animals that have a life history traits where they have long lives. They can sometimes live as long as 60 years or more. So they're very much on the same time scale as we are. But they lay lots of eggs all at once, just about every year, maybe every other year. And the idea is that they have adapted this strategy because they know that they're going to get a lot of predation. So the idea is that if one or two make it to become reproductive adults in their lifespan, one or two offspring do, then the population persists. But the way they do that is they lay lots of eggs and live a very long life to do it.
Hmm. We were at the White Memorial Conservation Center in Litchfield, and we're visiting with some of the people who make this park available to the public and educate about the native habitats and some of the species that are here. Okay, this is the part I've been looking forward to on the show. I told Jerry this yesterday. On my phone, the screensaver of my phone is a picture of this owl that we're going to meet here, Shakespeare the Owl. I've been coming here for years, and Shakespeare lives out back. is an injured owl, and we can learn a lot more in a second. But he's someone who greets visitors whenever you come for a hike. And maybe you can tell us a little bit more about Shakespeare.
Sure. Shakespeare is a barred owl. B-A-R-R-E-D, not to be confused with a barn owl. This is the most common type of owl that lives in this area, just named after the bars on the chest and on the back as well. And barred owls make a very distinctive call. Even if you've never seen a barred owl before, you've probably encountered it in some way, because you've probably heard it. The call that... Thank you, Jerry. Yes. That was not Shakespeare.
We'll have her do that more later for us.
Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? That's the catchphrase that's used. So many of you have probably heard that before. And Shakespeare was also a bird that was found injured in the wild. The wing was injured so badly that part of it had to be amputated, so he's no longer able to survive in the wild. So this is his permanent home, and he gets free housing, free health care, guaranteed meal every day, doesn't have to worry about predation. So he's doing pretty well, and the only trade-off is that he has to be our ambassador for the barred owl species and be an education animal, so that folks like you and kids, too, can get up close and personal with these amazing animals.
And it is an amazing animal. And, Jimmy, you were saying earlier, of course, our listeners can't see what Shakespeare's doing now. He's sitting very calmly, but a moment ago he was flapping his one good wing fairly furiously, but we heard nothing.
Nothing.
It's not like we heard a big flapping noise, and that's part of the reason that owls are able to, silently prey at night.
Yeah, they've adapted on their feathers and particularly on the primary feathers that they use for flight, they've adapted a fringe of tiny little plumes of feathers that sort of buffer the sound and make them a silent flyer. And that's pretty, it's advantageous when you're trying to catch something like a mouse in the middle of the night. So they have lots of different adaptations to do that.
Well, I'm so glad that we got to meet Shakespeare in person. She's such a handsome owl. I'm so glad you're able to come. So this is an unusual situation now. I was just saying the box turtle we were just talking to was very, very anxious to be talked to. Now I think the person who's anxious to get talked to is Jerry Griswold once again, because you're handling a full-size porcupine near, as I can tell. And I don't know how long you're supposed to hold a porcupine before you put that porcupine down. So maybe you can explain what you're doing and who this is.
Well, I've been a licensed wildlife rehabilitator since the early 1990s, and I specialize in bats, which I know we'll be talking about shortly. But porcupines have always had a soft spot in my heart. They're a native to the area where we live, John, up in the northwest corner and across the northern tier of the state. Yet most people don't even realize that they exist here in Connecticut. And in fact, in Jamie's studies around the property here, I think only once evidence of a porcupine has been seen on White Memorial's property. They live in Washington, they live in Burlington, they live in Harwinton, and they're just snubbing us, which is terrible. So this animal actually belongs to me. I'm licensed by the state and federal government to keep this animal permanently for use in programming. And her name is kind of odd. It's the new one. I believe she's an older animal.
Oh, the new one, yes.
The new one is her name. She was once the new one. Now she's my only porcupine, and a name kind of stuck. And they're a very curious animal. There are about 40 species of porcupines that live worldwide. The North American porcupine, which we have here, is the only porcupine species in North America. And they are the third largest rodent in the Americas, the largest rodent, of course, being the capybara, the beaver, of course, which we have as the symbol of the White Memorial Foundation.
You can see beavers here, absolutely.
Lots of beavers. And then, of course, the North American porcupine can be quite big. So I use her in programming. You can see she's kind of nervous. I'm a human pincushion. Yes, I have been really stuck by them, but they're really lovely animals. Can I tell you something beneficial that they do for you? One of the things that I learned from my mentor, Aldous Rose, who is the world authority on all species of porcupines, is that things in nature don't owe us anything. They're just here, and we're stewards. We're here to take care of them, not for them to give us something fabulous. So I think it's very conceited of the human animal to think that everything on the planet is here to serve us. I'll give you a laundry list of things that bats do for you. What does a porcupine do for you? Absolutely nothing. It's just a super cool animal.
It is a super cool animal, and you're wearing what I guess it's a porcupine shirt. I mean, what do you have to wear to handle
there was
a porcupine?
There was a lot of trial and error, John, to figure out what worked best. And
Kevlar? What is
it's
this?
It's just a leather shirt. It's a fabulous, funky, fabulous leather shirt. I could wear it out to dinner after I pick all the quills out of it.
Well, normally I would say I would love to pet the animals you're holding.
See, I can pet her with my bare hands.
But I think I'm going to pass.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for introducing us to the new one. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got more animals here to meet. We're at the White Memorial Conservation Center. It's one of, in case you can't tell, folks, it's one of my favorite places on the earth. It's in Litchfield, Connecticut, 4,000 beautiful acres of fields and woods and marshes and great places to swim and hike. And we're here visiting with some of the folks who make this place go. When we come back, we're going to get some questions from the audience. We're going to meet some more animals. And we're going to talk more about nature here on Where We Live. Live from White Memorial Conservation Center in Litchfield, Connecticut, this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're visiting with people from the White Memorial Conservation Center. It's a beautiful park right in the middle of Litchfield, right up against Bantam Lake. It is a park and center, so that there's a nature museum, there's educational programs. We're visiting with Carrie Schved, who's the education director here, Jamie Fisher, who's the research director, and Jerry Griswold, who's the director of administration and development at White Memorial. And you may very well know Jerry from a long time doing the traffic on WTIC AM, but she's here in her role as this as a steward of a place that we both love. And we're going to take some questions from the audience. We're going to meet some more animals here. Let's see, who's in the audience? I know who you are. Vita Muir is here from the Litchfield Jazz Festival. Hi, Vita.
Hello, John.
So tell us about this place. I know that the very first time I ever saw the Litchfield Jazz Festival was right here on the grounds.
Were you at the first festival?
I was at the very first festival.
Ah, and this is also the place where we had the very first camp.
And the reason we had the very first festival and the very first camp here is that, among other things, this is a very collegial organization. We were able to start the first festival here because Gene Mara, who was then the director, also was a serious jazz head. And he helped me to get a grant to start that first festival. It was a program called Partnerships for a Stronger Community. And so we put the festival here, and it was really spectacular. We would still be here, except for the fact that after the second festival, we hadn't expected it to be that popular. We put people on buses, and we discovered you cannot separate a New Englander from his car. And after the first first camp, we discovered that we needed beds. And White Memorial was gorgeous, and we loved being here, but I got exhausted begging grandmas to take kids from out of town, and I would take their children for free, their grandchildren for free. Excuse me, for free. So that's why we're now at Goshen.
Well, and yeah, but in many ways, the festival, the success of the festival outgrew this place. But yeah, I was here at the first one, and it
was beautiful.
It was a beautiful place for it. And you know, and we should tell people. And we had a program last week, the Litchfield Jazz Festival in Goshen, just up the road from here. It's next weekend. It's the 8th, 9th, and 10th.
It's this weekend.
This weekend. That's right. It's not next weekend. It's this weekend.
You have to remember.
The 8th, 9th, and 10th.
You're coming.
I'm gonna be there, absolutely. Vitamir, thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim.
And if you have any questions for us, please raise your hand and grab the microphone. Jerry?
Yeah, I just want to say, to tag on to Vita, I started a festival as well called Iceland Affair, and it started right here as a one-day program in the activity shed to celebrate everything Iceland, and we've outgrown White Memorial as well. So it's October 18th. It's just a one-day festival experiencing the nature and culture and the food and the animal life of Iceland, and in the evening is a grand concert with six of the greatest recording artists in the nation in Iceland coming down to play at Infinity Hall in Norfolk. So that's October 18th. And again, it started right here at White Memorial. So the property is for rent here. The carriage house has bunk beds and dormitories for school groups or any kind of group, actually. You can rent it for weddings. So it is such a unique organization where buildings can be rented and you can have overnights here and weddings can be had. And there's so much that we have to offer. I think we often forget how much we have to offer.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We've been here when there's weddings here, and there's so much going on at the same time. Boy Scout events and everything else.
Free camping for all nonprofit groups. We have two campgrounds, so you can call the foundation office for information about that.
Before we meet some bats, so who's got a question or a thought here? Hi there. What's your name?
Mark from Litchfield.
Hi, Mark.
And the question's for, I guess, Jamie. If you could explain to the public the program that you are working on over at the intersection of 63 and 61 with the utilities, I think people would be quite interested.
Yeah.
And a second follow-up is for land trusts and organizations such as that in the area. You, I believe, did a Phragmites remediation removal.
Sure.
And
sure.
Do you offer advice, consulting, or whatever for local land trusts?
Well, I'll start with your first part of your question. It's a unique, it's part experiment, part demonstration area. It's referred to as StormWise. And it's there are demonstration areas in each county of the state. We are the one for Litchfield County. It's a collaboration between Connecticut Agriculture Experiment Station, the U.S. Forest Service, University of Connecticut, and then the landowners themselves being White Memorial Foundation, and then the utility companies. And the idea is that we're demonstrating that we can steward or manage a forest that is growing near or next to power lines, but it is because of the way we've harvested the trees and the way we're encouraging the regeneration to occur at that site, the trees are less likely to fall on the power lines in the future whenever we have another storm like we did a couple years ago where we had back-to-back power outages for multiple days at a time and really impacted the northwest corner communities a great deal. This is just a really neat opportunity to show people that you can have a forest and it can be growing near power lines, but it doesn't have to necessarily be tall trees growing right up against the power line that then could subsequently fall on it. The second part of your question, dealing with Phragmites. Phragmites is an invasive plant species that's been around for many, many years. And in some places, and most places, it becomes so abundant and dominant in wetlands that it actually changes the way the wetlands function, and then that affects drinking water supplies and so forth. And there are programs in the state that manage Phragmites, and they're facilitated through Connecticut DEEP, primarily the Wildlife Division. But we could offer advice based upon our own personal experiences here at White Memorial with dealing with Phragmites control, and we've learned a great deal about it. And then, fortunately, we have a lot of people in the state who work for Connecticut DEEP who can offer some practical advice on either acquiring those funds for their land trusts. And it's a very important thing to consider and to do, because it does have a huge impact. And, we have stands of Phragmites that, just as a demonstration, I could say that we had stands of Phragmites that were just a few stems about 6 or 7 years ago, and they're multiple acres in size. It grows very fast. It can colonize and expand very quickly in some habitats. And so it's something we're always trying to stay on top of. The prescriptions and the methods are very precise and very specific, but it's something that I would encourage other land trusts to explore to see if it's feasible for them.
Mm. If you have questions for our experts here at White Memorial Conservation Center, just raise your hand. We'll get you the microphone. I know that, Jerry, you've got some other friends to introduce us to. You've taken off your porcupine shirt.
Yes.
And you've put down the owls.
We're going to have a raffle. Count the quills in the shirt. Win a prize.
Well, so, and this is the thing that you really love. You love bats.
Yeah, near and dear to my heart always have been bats. As a child growing up in Winchester, bats are part and parcel of the ecology of living on a farm. So I always grew up with a healthy batitude, and I became a wildlife rehabilitator in 1992. And my concentration was bats when I think only one other person in the state was actually working with them. Well, it's changed a lot since then. There are many more people involved in the rehabilitation of bats now, which is terrific, not just in Connecticut, but around the world. But something happened in 2006 that has gravely affected our population. It's called white nose syndrome. And I know that you guys have been very good about keeping that in the forefront of the news. About 8 million animals have died since 2006 when white nose syndrome entered the United States by mistake, a fungus that came in from Europe and dropped into a cave by mistake up in New York State. And our largest hibernaculum for bats in Connecticut is Mine Hill down in Roxbury, where 4,000 little brown bats once lived. Every single one of them died. And these little animals are crucial to life. All bats are crucial to life on Earth, whether they're insect eaters, which is their primary role, but they're pollinators and seed dispersers. And I wasn't kidding at the beginning of the show. The bananas, bats are pollinators of wild banana plants. So bats, the impact that these animals make on you is something that occurs day to day, whether they're eating the mosquitoes or whether they're putting food on your table. There isn't an animal in the world that impacts human life positively on a day-to-day basis more than a bat. And yet they're still vilified because we've only cared to study them for about 60 or 70 years. So I intercept some pretty interesting animals, and one of the animals I brought with me today, and I'm sure I'll be soundly bitten, is a state-threatened species called an eastern red bat. And this animal is threatened because of habitat destruction. It lives in maple trees, and they're very rare. This is a female, and she came to me from Waterbury, and she's very angry with me, of course. Don't try this at home. She's biting through my glove, and I'm sure she'll get to my hand eventually. But she has a bruised radius, basically, a bruised radius, not a broken arm, which is terrific. And so hopefully she'll have a good future. I hope to release her this year. But it's really incredible having an animal like this, because I think most people think bats are just brown, when we have three species of migratory bats in our state that are wildly colorful and really beautiful. The payback, though, is that they're not as smart as the brown bats, so they sacrifice the beauty for the brains, or the brains for the beauty. So she's not the brightest bat in the box, but it sure is fun having her. They'll migrate maybe a couple of 100 miles south for the winter, and they will hibernate in the fronts of caves. So where the fungus that is killing the crevice-dwelling bats is, it's a cold-loving fungus deep in the caves that's hurting our little brown bats and other species similar, the mosquito eaters. This bat is roosting in the fronts of caves and not being affected, or at least they don't believe it's being affected yet.
And the white nose syndrome, that again, it really got its start in the United States in upstate New York. Mm-hmm. So we have some experience with it here in Connecticut. Do we know anything about how quickly it is moving, about how it is affecting the bat populations in Connecticut or the rest of New England now?
I don't know. Jamie might be able to expound a little bit more on that.
It's having a dramatic impact throughout New England, and it's now moving. The fungus has been documented going through southern Appalachian Mountains and westward.
Alabama.
Yeah.
Oklahoma.
Westward. Yeah.
Kentucky.
It's spreading very rapidly. There are several rare species of bats that nationwide that are potentially impacted. We may lose them forever. I mean, these could be extinction events, and this has all happened in a matter of 7 years or so.
Is there a major national
initiative? We're just getting asked, is there a big national initiative on what's being done to...
There's at least education going on through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and there are regional programs throughout the country trying to address this at a regional as well as national level. There are also non-for-profit organizations throughout the United States, like Bat Conservation International, and that are trying to front the education effort as well as some of the conservation efforts. There are some strategies that have been explored to possibly mitigate the impact by, but again, this is happening so fast, it's difficult to set up conservation strategies and programs, and to see how effective they are in their conservation efforts.
I want to, Jerry, you want to jump in?
Yeah, a burr under my saddle is that $970,000 of federal funding has gone to this problem, and that's unconscionable. We could all go to the casino and have a ball with that and just get rid of it immediately, and that's split up amongst 28 states. That's crazy for an animal that is crucial to life on Earth, that we're allowing species to literally teeter on the brink of extinction. Nothing has ever harmed us in such a way to wipe out our species, but white nose syndrome threatens species, and it's unconscionable that there isn't more funding available for the study of this or how to eradicate it. Mm-hmm. And it's really tough. It's just hit so hard and so fast. And these little animals have such a low birth rate. They're long living, they're low reproducing, they give birth just once a year. So it just really sucker punched us. And so it's difficult to bring back little brown bat populations when they were literally wiped out before we could even realize how acute the situation was.
It's being referred to as the worst ecological disaster that we've ever faced, at least in this generation. And it's going to take multiple decades for the bat population to rebound, if they ever do.
We just have a few minutes left in the program, and I know that we have one more question from out here. Hi there, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Sharon, and I'm a Torrington native. And I just wanted to expand on what Carrie said about the children's education. My summers were pretty much spent here at White Memorial. And I think that when you can start your childhood here, you continue. I wouldn't outgrow it. I haven't outgrown it. And the membership for the Conservation Center definitely pays for itself with admission to the museum, which we haven't touched on just yet. But I have so many memories of going through the museum. And I was so ecstatic when they did the renovation. And I've brought my niece and nephew through. They've gone to camp here repeatedly over the summers. And I just wanted to let people know that if you start here, you'll probably continue. And even listening to the panel today, I've learned more, even though I've been here several times before. So
thank you very much for saying that, too. And the museum upstairs is a beautiful place. We have 2 minutes left, and we've got one little more friend that we just want to be introduced to, Jerry.
I don't think she's a friend.
Oh, no.
This is one of the very important bats that Jamie referred to. It's a northern long-eared. And this little animal made the news just a couple of weeks ago, and that Fish and Wildlife is considering putting this animal on the endangered species list. Crucial to life on Earth in that this little critter eats about 1,200 mosquitoes in an hour on a summer night. They're just incredible. And this type of bat, a Myotis species, is the animal that is being really gravely affected by white nose syndrome. So my situation is that I wonder public health implications moving down the line, mosquito-borne diseases, equine encephalitis, West Nile virus, things like heartworm that your dogs get, their own mosquito-borne, even malaria that was in Connecticut 100 years ago in New Haven, documented cases of malaria, with these animals making such a huge impact on mosquito populations and disappearing, what does that mean for us in the long term? We really need to wake up and smell the coffee.
And I'm so glad that we got to that, because these you were joking about the porcupine. What do porcupines do for us? Not much, but some of these animals, they do an awful lot for us. And I'm so glad you're able to bring them here and talk about this important issue in this important and amazing place. Jerry Griswold and Carrie Shred and Jamie Fisher, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so
we
much for your
you.
Time.
You're thank welcome. You so much. Thank you, everybody.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. Our interns today, Allison Ehrenreich and Katie Pikus, and the executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. And we're thrilled to be at White Memorial Conservation Center. You can find them online. You can find out about all the hiking trails and the things to do here. I'm so glad we got to spend a little bit of our morning here. We'll go on a hike. This is Where We Live.